This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is GM Capricious Nature, and this is episode 1 of How to Play and How to GM Death in Space. I am very happy to be here with all of you, and I hope this is informative and can help anybody and everybody start their journey on the Death in Space adventure itself, especially seeing as a brand new supplement is going to be coming out very soon. I hope all of you can find this informative and helpful, and let's get it started. So, first and foremost, Death in Space is a wonderful, wonderful tabletop RPG created by Free League Publishing. Authored by Christian Folgfors and Carl Nablus. My apologies if I'm butchering any names there, but it is one of my favorite kind of rules-light RPG systems that comes with an absolutely wonderful hard copy book. As you can see, mine has already been used quite a bit just in the last few sessions that we've been running so far on our stream over at Cybernation Uncensored at Twitch. And it has been an absolute blast so far, and I hope you guys can join us over on twitch.tv/Cybernation Uncensored. That being said, when it comes to Death in Space, this is our introduction to how to play and how to get started. So what we're going to be focusing in on is the very first steps of how do you build your characters, how do you build your team, how do you build your hub, and what exactly are all these different pieces that come together to build and create characters. Now, first and foremost, we need to know about the setting itself. So the setting is, well, Death in Space. Death in Space is all about dying in space and, you know, the death of space as well. According to the setting descriptions and according to the book, this is in the future in which the universe is no longer expanding, but it seems to be collapsing. And so on page number 5, it says, "The vast blackness of space is collapsing in a slow grind towards eternal nothingness. Heralding the collapse is the void, a strange presence that infects and corrupts. So say the Navvies, workers who travel further into uncharted space than anyone else, as they return with stories from faraway systems. Some Navvies claim to have seen strange creatures, out there behemoths drifting from the edge of the cosmos, seeking shelter in the civilized systems. Scientists, of course, reject such claims, calling them tales and nightmares. Yet, everyone, even among them, there are some who assert that the universe has stopped expanding. Instead, they say it is now compressing at an accelerated rate towards an inevitable crushing crunch." So this is the setting itself for Death in Space, is that we're no longer in an expanding universe. We're far enough in the future where the actual universe is experiencing the Great Crunch, according to some scientific theories. And so, because of the Great Crunch, we have the emergence of the Void throughout the game itself. And we'll be talking about that a little bit later. The second part about the setting that we need to know about is the starting area, as you can see on our little graphic here. The Iron Ring is considered to be the starting point. And the starting point for the Iron Ring is here in what we call the Tenebris system. And the Iron Ring is quite literally a hodgepodge collection of old spaceship and spacecraft, old space stations that have been put together and welded together in hopes of trying to create some kind of semi-homogeneous ecosystem for people to live and survive in. And so the Iron Ring itself has a bunch of locations, and you can find them in the book on page 104 and 105. There's literally dozens and dozens of locations all over the Iron Ring that you can visit. The starting adventure as well starts off in the Iron Ring, and all of this is to try and showcase to the players, as well as any audience that you might be streaming to, just how desolate and how destroyed the future is. Because according to the lore of the universe, we have the game taking place 10 or more years after what was called the Gem Wars, in which these major corporations literally destroyed the known universe's economy in order to try and get after this valuable resource. And so there's no production of anything new. Corporations aren't making anything new. There's nothing that's really not repurposed or reused from the past. And so the game itself tries to show how storage containers and old spacecraft parts and weapons themselves are all just being held together by, duct tape and sheer will. And of course, every person's toolkit needs duct tape as well as WD-40, so you need them both. Now, when it comes to getting started, what we are going to be taking a look at next, outside of just the setting, is the actual character creation. And so, for the character creation, there's the abilities, the origin, the character details, past allegiances, hit points and defense rating, and starting gear and starting bonuses. And all of this can be found in your book, for starting your character on page number 12. And the abilities that you focus on, there's just four, and it's very, very simple system. You've got body, and it's bodily strength and physical resistance, as well as melee attacks. You have dexterity, which is all about your reflexes, your poise, and your speed. You have savvy, which is about perception, intuition, psychological resistance, and piloting spacecraft, as well as tech, understanding and operating technology, and ranged attacks. And so what happens is that in order to put your abilities together, you roll 2d4. Now, the reason you roll 2d4 is not to add them together, but the first of the 2d4 is the base, and then the second of the 2d4 is what you subtract from the base. And so if you roll a 4 and then you roll a 2, that means that your total ability is now 2. So you've subtracted 2 from that 4. Okay, so there's no way to really get past 3 in an ability score at starting creation. We also have the wonderful origins that the game has come up with. We've got carbon, which is all about being grown in space-based exo-wombs. These folks live short lifespans, and they're off-world and untroubled by the darkness of space. They're more comfortable in EVA suits than out of one. So the carbon is quite literally just a lab-grown person. We have the chrome, which is an AI placed into a body vessel of organic material. So you have an artificial intelligence that's inside of a meat suit, pretty much. You've got the punk, which is your homegrown humans. They're rebellious and nonconformist with a long history. They've seen civilizations collapse and others turn against each other. So your punks themselves are one of the major characters. If you want to play just a regular human, the punk is the way to go. We have the Soul Pot, which is a very interesting origin, because what has happened is that these people are scientists that live inside of hibernation pods, and they wake up every couple of decades or every few hundred years in order to study the collapse of the universe. And depending on what year you decide to set your game in, a soul pod could just be a couple hundred years old, or a soul pod could be a couple thousand years old. And one of the things that me and my character, or my players, did is that when we rolled for the abilities and origin, I also had them roll for what year it was. And so we combined the years, and our setting is in the year 5033. So we're 3,000 years into the future. And because of that, if we did have any soul pods in our game, they could be, you know, 2,000 years old or 3,000 years old because of their ability to go into hibernation and come back. You have your velocity cursed, which is one of the most unique aspects of this game. The velocity cursed, as it says here, is ill-fated ones that have started to lose their connection to reality. They shift and flicker in and out of space-time with glitching faces. And the actual velocity cursed, you can flavor this in any way you want. I've seen people create characters where they're literally like, they're almost transparent, and you can like, you can barely physically touch them, or they'll actually flash in and out of reality. And if you check out cybernationuncensored.com, you can actually find a supplement that I've put together that includes some major issues that the characters run into, which we'll talk in a little bit when it comes to Flavortown. But the velocity curse will actually disappear for a couple of rounds if they fail a void check, which we'll be talking about in a bit. Now, the last one is the Void. And the Void are robed Nihility shamans, hidden behind masks, speaking through synthetic scramblers. They've seen visions of the end of the universe and the edge of the universe. And the Void themselves are folks that are quite literally just, they're the cultists that are here for the end. And they're the ones predicting that all of this is just falling in on itself. And because of that, their characters can be very, very unique. And one of the players that I have, they have a very big focus on the static. And so they'll listen to static, they'll talk and pray in static. And so the reason that they do that is because the static is coming from this background radiation from the collapsing of the universe. And so it's a way to kind of mix the setting with the origin. Now, the character details are what you can find on page 14, 15, as well as page 16 and 17, all the way until page number 18, in which you get all these things from their drive to what traits they have, the background that they lived, the actual details of what they look like, and their past allegiances. And so all of these different aspects, what you can do is, you can have the characters roll for it, so the players will roll 1d6 for each of these different tables, or 1d20 for each of these different tables, depending on which table it is. Or they can pick and choose and try and create a character that fits the kind of mood that they're going for. And so there's two different ways to really approach this. What I did is I actually allowed my characters and my players to choose which one they wanted. And a couple of them said, you know, screw it, I'm going to roll it. I'm going to roll with the RNG gods and see what comes out. And we've had some very creative characters come out from that. Now, the interesting aspect of the character details is the past allegiances, because the past allegiances are this very interesting way to add a little bit more flavor to the character and where they came from, where they were in the past. And so you can have them be allegiant to an idea. So their belief, their convictions are what they follow and what matters to them the most. You can have them be allied with a family or their own family, which could bring in some really, really big role-playing opportunities of bringing family members into the game itself. There's the winning versus the losing side, and so you can have them allied to the winning side, even though there was no winner of the Gem Wars. Or you can have them allied to the losing side, and they're just kind of sullen about the loss of the war itself. You can have them allied to contracts. They're just focused on living day to day, contract to contract, hollow to hollow, just trying to survive and live. And so that's a big one that a lot of people usually choose, or they often go with none. They have no allegiance because if they don't have an allegiance, then they can be focused on themselves. It says here, you side only with yourself and avoided the war as well as you could. And this is a common one I've seen a lot of players use because it allows them the most freedom when it comes to creating and shaping their characters. But I personally think that having family, winning side, or losing side is a great way to introduce some extra flavor into the campaign itself. Now, hit points and defense rating are what happens after you finish up with the starting gear and starting bonuses. Sorry, no, they come before. So you start with 1d8 maximum hit points, and when you rest, you recover 1d8 plus your body for hit points. So what happens is that your body starts out at a 1d8. The maximum you can get is an 8, the lowest you can get is a 1. And this leads to very, very squishy characters. And so when you're designing and creating your game and you're running your session zero, it's really important to try and inform your players that one or two bullets could kill you. It's very, very common to lose your character in this game because players are so squishy. And that comes along with the defense rating because your defense rating starts out as a 12, just a base 12. And from there, if you get additional armor or you get higher dex, you can increase your defense rating. But if you rolled really badly on your abilities, let's say you rolled a 1 for your first d4 and then you rolled a 4 for your next, well, you're at a negative 3 dex. Which means that your unarmored defense rating goes from 12 all the way down to 9. So when somebody attacks you, they only need to have a 9 in order to hit, which makes it very, very dangerous for them in combat. Now, the last part of creating your characters on page 22 and 23 are the starting gear and starting bonuses, and these are d6s and a d20 in order to just kind of get your character set up with what they own. So they might have a random cosmic mutation, they might have additional starting HP, they might have a EVA suit, they could have a pistol, they could have an AI guard animal, or they could have an old crew member that you yourself as the GM control. But when it comes to the starting bonus, what I actually wanted to do is I wanted my characters or my players to choose which one that they wanted the most, because if you really don't want an EVA suit and you want a pistol because your character is going to be combat focused, you should allow your players to kind of choose that. If your character really wants to have this kind of protected person, this squishy character, a protected person, then let them choose that AI guard animal to kind of protect them a little bit. Or if you want to have a pilot who has a co-pilot, then let them choose to have an old crew member who's still with them. You know, it's up to the GM, but in the end, I wanted my players to choose because it gives them more agency on the character creation side. And the same thing can be said about the starting kit. You can be a prospector, a ring thug, a mercenary, a nomad, an engineer, or an explorer, and each of these come with their own unique content. And you're limited by your body slots or your item slots, which is 12 plus your body. So if you have a 12 and your body is a negative one, then you only have 11 slots. Well, if you only have 11 slots, then your starting content could be filling up most of your inventory. And so allowing your players, again, to kind of choose which one that they want really gives them more flexibility. And when it comes to the personal trinket, this is one that I actually wanted them to roll on, because it really allows flavor to be added to the character themselves, as well as all of these interesting background details. And so the starting gear and starting bonuses are a very interesting aspect to getting the character flavored and getting them all set up, as well as getting the character themselves fleshed out a little bit more. Now, the next one is hub creation. Now, hub creation is one of the neatest aspects of this game. Starts on page number 26. And what happens is that your players are actually making their own space station or their own spacecraft. And so they get to choose what kind of frame they want. And what it recommends in the book is that if your characters are going to be more exploration focused, then they should choose a spacecraft to allow them to fly around, use up fuel to move from place to place. If you're going to have a very centered or very limited movement in which your characters are really kind of sticking to the Iron Ring, or if you have a planet or some other kind of setting that you want them to stick to, then a space station would probably be a better frame to choose because it moves less and actually allows for more customization because of its size. But no matter what you have, the actual hub itself starts out with a couple of different things. First and foremost, is you have a command center, which is the hub's bridge. You have the crew quarters, so every character has their own quarters, which they can go into and sleep. This is very, very important. I want to stress that. Very important, because it's one of the only ways in the entire game to regain HP, is if your character sleeps inside of a protected area, such as your hub, inside of their own crew quarters. If they don't remember to sleep, if they don't remember to get these rests, then these very squishy characters could very quickly die. And you want to try and make sure that your campaign is as long-lived as possible, unless you're playing, like me, a grimdark setting in which I'm not really giving them much of a choice. They're just going in and engaging with the universe that I've set up for them. Now, you have the hub's bridge, the command center, you have the crew quarters, you also have life support, which is the basic function. So even if you run out of fuel, the life support systems still run, which means that there's still oxygen, there's still heating, there's still water, and there's still artificial gravity. So your space station and your spaceship have artificial gravity. Now, you can choose as the GM to have artificial gravity or not, but one of the biggest issues that you're going to run into for not having artificial gravity, because I've already seen this done, is the fact that having your characters do dex checks just to move around inside of a zero G space station or inside of a zero G spacecraft, if they've lost their fuel, it can turn into quite a mess pretty quickly, and it can get very frustrating. So I highly recommend you stick with the core rule book and have artificial gravity. be part of your life support system. You also have the mess, which is the only place large enough for the whole crew to sit together and talk about anything. Okay, so one of the things that they stress is that your hub or your spacecraft is kind of cramped and it's very hodgepodge. And no matter what, at the end of the day, the mess hall is kind of where everybody is going to be able to sit together and talk and get through everything. Now, when it comes to your power source, if you have a spacecraft, it's a standard chemical engine. It's slow and it requires fuel to move your craft from one location to the next. And if you're on a station, then your standard industrial generator is what you're going to be using. And what's we need to remind our players is that for the station itself, turning it on and off, just starting your station requires a full unit of fuel. And so fuel is a precious commodity that they're going to have to keep track of, because just moving your ship, if you're in a spacecraft, or starting up your station, if you're in a space station, it uses fuel. So the output power and the fuel itself are very important to understand. Now, the next really, really cool part is the hub background. And the hub background for the spacecraft and the space station gives it a lot and a lot and a lot of flavor, because it could have been previously used by gangsters, or it might have been used by punks that have left graffiti on the walls, or it could be void cursed, and every once in a while you'll find a random body part, which is part of the hub quirk. These backgrounds and these quirks are two really, really cool aspects of the hub that give your spacecraft or your space station a lot of character, because every character needs characterization, and your hub itself is a character in the game. And so having that hub background and hub quirk is a great way to do so. Now, the next part is Flavortown. And Flavortown is all about the void. And the void inside of this game is all about void points and void corruptions. And this is on page 38 and 39. As well as the void mutations, or the cosmic mutations, on page 40 and 41. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the video, if you check out cybernationuncensored.com, I'm going to be releasing a supplement that will continuously evolve and grow that includes new void corruptions based on your actual character's origin. So if you're a Chrome, then maybe you vomit out your voice box, or maybe if you're a void touched, then you will shift out of reality. Sorry, velocity cursed. You'll shift out of reality for 1d4 rounds and reappear tied up, hog tied, naked after failing a void check. And so there's quite a bit of flavor that you can add in with that. But what the heck are void points is the most important thing that we need to get. Is a void point is a point that is gained which each failed ability check or attack roll. So every single time that your characters roll, there's two possible outcomes. You're rolling against a DR12, so difficulty rating is always 12, standard 12. Unless the GM decides that it's a more difficult task and they can choose to have something higher, but the game makers recommend sticking with 12. And if the player rolls under the DR12, they will automatically gain a void point. And these void points stack until you get up to 4 points. Now, the reason that it stacks up to four void points is because you can use these void points for a lot of different things. You can use it to gain advantage on an ability check. You can use it to gain advantage on an attack roll. Or you can use it to activate a cosmic mutation. Now, void points are really, really, really useful. And it's one thing that I'm trying to impart on my players, is that you need to use your void points, especially because the more void points you have, the higher a chance it is that you might have a void corruption from a failed void check. Because what happens is that a void corruption, it means that if you use a void point when you make a roll and you fail that roll, then you have a 1d6 that you have to roll. And if the result is underneath or equal to the number of void points you have, then you now have a corruption. And some of these corruptions are pretty brutal. They can maim your character. They could possibly take away a physical ability of your character, or they might just make something, you know, weird. It could just be a little odd. But having these void points stack up is something that you want to avoid, because the void points themselves are so useful. Especially with the cosmic mutations being these ridiculously useful skills that you have the ability to utilize using void points, like telekinesis, telepathy, thermal conduction, having two hearts, or a boosted metabolism. There's tons of different cosmic mutations you can have that you can only activate by using void points. And so it's best to try and utilize your void points to get your advantage on your rolls. It's best to use them to utilize your cosmic mutations, because it allows you so much more flexibility and a much higher chance of success. But it comes at a cost, comes at a risk of getting a void corruption. Now, this is our introduction to Death in Space. How do you build your character? How do you understand what the different origins are? How you get your void points? How you choose and craft your hub? And what's going to be coming up next is there's going to be additional videos coming out where I'm going to teach how you play through the combat mechanics, which are actually very, very simple, but could be very foreign to people who have been playing things like Cyberpunk, or have been playing things like Fallout or Dungeons and Dragons. It's a very different system. And so we're going to have a video on combat coming up next. Now, in the meantime, you can check us out over at cybernationuncensored.com, you can check us out over on Discord, and you can check us out over on Twitch. There's tons of different ways you can reach out to our community. We are absolutely, absolutely open to just about everybody, because we want to include as many people in the community as possible, and part of that is by teaching people who are interested on how to run these kinds of systems. So if you check out our YouTube channel as well, you can find tutorials on how to play and run Cyberpunk Red. And later on, there's going to be other tutorials being put together to play things like The Walking Dead that just came out recently, as well as Alien RPG and tons of others. So I just wanted to give a big shout out to our founder, Rob Mulligan. Thank you so much for everything and the opportunity to come on and teach our wonderful audience about how to play Death in Space, as well as our bi-weekly Twitch that you can come and check out. We're now on session number 2, where we just experienced our very first touch of combat, and you can check us out over at twitch.tv/CyberNationUncensored. So, I hope to see you folks there. And I'll see you in the next video. Until then, have a great day, have a great night, have a great afternoon, and I hope to see you. Bye. CyberNation Uncensored.